From the ACC, this is Kim Eagle, Editor-in-Chief of ACC.org, with this week's Eagle's Eye View. This is your weekly cardiovascular update from ACC.org. In this week's podcast, I was able to catch up with Deepak Bhatt and Peter Block for a discussion of the late-breaking clinical trials from the American Heart Association meeting in Anaheim. I think you'll enjoy them and some very important trials that affect practice at this meeting.
I'm Peter Block in Anaheim, California at the AHA annual meeting, and this is a wrap-up for day number one. To my left is Deepak Bhatt from the Brigham and Women's in Boston, and to my way far left, almost out of the picture, is Kim Eagle from the University of Michigan. So there are three trials we want to talk about at this first day: PRESERVE, Bruise Control, and TRIX 3. And I'm going to talk a little bit about PRESERVE to start with, since I've got the mic in my hand.
Absolutely.
And I've got control. So this is a trial for acetylcysteine versus sodium bicarb versus sodium chloride and so forth. And acetylcysteine finally gets pulled off the shelf and we can throw it away. At least I hope so. So Deepak, give me a quick run on this trial.
Yeah, I'm a big believer in it. It is an important question whether to use these different renal protection strategies that small studies published in high-tier journals said were effective. They've gone into widespread use worldwide, and now a definitive trial has shown no benefit of N-acetylcysteine or sodium bicarb. So just stick with prehydration with saline, try to minimize the volume of contrast.
You know, I do this a little differently. I actually, before the patient sees any contrast, check their LVED, and if it's in the normal or low range, I will push that up to high normal, simply to give them volume so the kidneys start to diurese before they see any contrast. I don't know if that's the right or wrong thing. Maybe that's another trial, but there you have it.
It was a trial, the Poseidon trial.
Oh, okay, and that showed, did it work?
Yeah, it worked.
So give it at the front end.
Yeah, measure the LVDP, use that to titrate volume.
So why did we use acetylcysteine still?
Because, you know, there was an initial very positive small trial published in a high-tier journal, and, you know, then it impacts practice. People keep doing it.
Truth has nothing to do with randomized trials. Or vice versa.
Peter, I thought this was a really good trial, the 2x2 factorial design with sodium bicarb versus just saline, and then an acetylcysteine. Everybody got about a liter of fluid, and absolutely no signal at all of benefit from acetylcysteine. And we've been doing this how long? Thinking it works, it's got to be a decade or more.
The fact is, I don't think a liter is enough for some folks. This is why I mentioned the LVED business.
Yeah, I think you're right.
I agree with you. Also, I've got to credit the VA for doing this trial, answering these important questions in a several thousand patient study.
All right, moving on. Bruise control. Deepak, it's all yours.
Sure. So this was a nice study. It was, I think, also very informative. Took patients undergoing EP procedures and randomized them either to continuation of NOAC or interruption of NOAC. And, you know, it wasn't a lot of events, but within the context of what statistical power they had, it seemed you could basically go with either strategy, no harm, no foul with either approach, either in terms of ischemic or thromboembolic events or bleeding events. So if you choose to continue the DOAC for the EP procedure, this study would support that. If you want to interrupt, the study supports that too.
This is a nice follow-up of Bruise Control 1, where they looked at the question, should you continue warfarin or not, suggesting that continuation of warfarin was safe. I like this trial a lot because there are certain patients who have a very high thromboembolic risk where you say, you know what, I think I want to continue the agent. And there are also those at high bleeding risk, peripheral vascular disease, maybe the very elderly, where you say, you know, I think I want to interrupt. And the risk of stroke and or major bleeding was identical in both arms. So it really gives clinicians freedom to make a good choice based on the individual patient.
And we know that patients who are, you know, have high CHA2DS2 FAST scores, high risk for thromboembolism, if you stop the anticoagulation, they get into trouble.
Absolutely.
With thromboemboli, I should say, So I think that's a good trial for all kinds of reasons.
Absolutely. It gives the operator some freedom to use discretion. I like it.
All right, let's move on. TRIX 3. So, Kim, it comes to you. The transfusion after cardiac surgery. Should you or should you not transfuse? At what level of hemoglobin?
Yeah, this has been a challenge for us for years. You know, how low do you let the hemoglobin drop after a bypass operation or a major cardiac operation before you transfuse? This is a randomized trial of 5,000 patients. And an aggressive cut point was transfusing at 9.5, a hemoglobin of 9.5, versus a more restricted at 7.5. And absolutely no difference in overall event rates, one bit. So this really, I think, helps us understand that we don't need to transfuse patients until their hemoglobin drops typically below 8 to 7.5. And we all know that blood transfusions carry their own risks. They can affect immunity, increasing the risk of postoperative infection. So I think this is a practice-changing trial.
And blood transfusions carry a long-term risk, too, which is not immaterial. I mean, we have to remember that. They're not good for you. On the other hand, Kim, you and I argued a little about this before we started all this business about, well, your patient's got a hemoglobin of 7, and he's not doing so well, and do you really want to give 2 or 3 units of blood to make them better? And you said, give them some volume instead. You still really believe that, Kim?
So this study says if their hemoglobin is 7.5 or higher, I can replete their volume without it being blood, and it's probably safer.
Yeah, I agree. I'm going to change my mind.
Good.
And there's also the cost implications, too, right? Blood's an expensive resource, sometimes a scarce resource, so probably don't want to really transfuse unless there's a good reason, and this trial says there's not a good reason.
Any last words about any of the trials? Which do you think of those three is the most important?
Well, I think PRESERVE sort of puts the nail in the coffin of N-acetylcysteine once and for all, and we really needed the trial to do that. And I think the TRIX3 is a big study that really does change the game in terms of when you transfuse. Our EP colleagues are going to be happy with bruise control because it's been debated whether we should stop or continue the NOACs.
So I ask you, which of the three are the most important? You said all three?
Yeah, it depends on the patient, Peter.
There you go.
Like always.
You know, I like his diplomatic answers. That was pretty good.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty good,
I don't think I could do better than that answer.
From Anaheim, California, thanks a lot, folks. I'm Peter Block at Anaheim, California, at the AH Annual Meeting, and it is day 2 for On the Scene. On my left is Deepak Bhatt from the Brigham Women's Hospital. Sorry, Deepak. And then on the far left, Kim Eagle from the University of Michigan. And we're here to review the day's trials and where we stand after day 2. We've got 2 important trials today. CANTOS was a reduction of inflammation after myocardial infarction. And GATEWAY, a bariatric surgery study, one of my favorites. So Deepak, go with CANTOS.
Sure. I think it's a terrific study. It was presented at ESC, of course, with great fanfare. But what was presented here, I think, is as important. It was really an analysis from CANTOS looking at response to therapy. So just in case people have forgotten, CANTOS examined the inflammation hypothesis, canakinumab, in coronary patients to see if that anti-inflammatory drug would reduce ischemic events, which it did in the overall trial. Also an intriguing finding of reduced lung cancer in the trial. But what was shown here were patients and their CRP response to canakinumab. Of course, you had to have an elevated CRP to get into the trial. But then those patients who had a significant reduction in CRP, in those folks, the drug seemed to work like gangbusters. That is, there was a reduction in all-cause mortality in those patients. So
you had to get to be less than 2.
That's correct. Yeah. So in those patients, it seems like if you had a response, you had a really great response. In the other patients, the response wasn't nearly so robust. So it does open the door to potential really personalized therapy. And this drug, you know, we don't know what its approval status or cost would be. But in theory, one could envision a world where if it were approved, you give a dose. If the patient has a significant response, then you continue it. And if they don't, you stop it. And then you could really maximize benefit, hopefully minimize harm and minimize cost. So it could be
attractive. Kim, you're worried about the harm.
Well, yeah, so, you know, this drug potentially can cause a higher risk of infection. And in the first study that was reported earlier, there was, I think, a doubling of fatal infections.
And still is in this trial.
There is, but the good news is that this trial suggests that the overall mortality and the cardiac mortality trumps that hazard, and so that certainly is good news. The other part that Deepak mentioned is that this response to the drug potentially allows us only to use it in patients who are going to respond and not use it in other patients. So then we get rid of that risk.
Well, this is like treating hypercholesterolemia, right? Give a statin. If your LDL goes down and your total cholesterol goes down, you continue the statin. If not, look somewhere else.
Yeah, and it's very common in the diabetes world where endocrinologists will start, say, a DPP-4 inhibitor. If there's not a good response, they won't just continue those expensive medicines. So, you know, that type of personalization, I think, makes a lot of sense. We don't do a lot of it in cardiovascular, but maybe we'll start.
All right, let's move to bariatric surgery, since you just said diabetes.
Oh, right.
Bariatric surgery in people with very high BMIs. Kim, give this one a shot. What do you think about hypertension and bariatric surgery?
So this Gateway was a randomized trial of a fairly small number of patients that were randomized to either bariatric surgery or typical medical therapy, and the primary endpoint was looking at blood pressure control. And it was very interesting. The group that got bariatric surgery, half of the patients needed no antihypertensives after the Roux-en-Y gastric procedure, which is an enormous benefit. And they were all on two or more, yeah. So certainly gastric bypass surgery, for at least the short term, suggests that it has a big effect on blood pressure control.
Yeah. And, you know, I have a good friend who is interested in this whole business of diet and whether or not diets long term can ever do anything. And he says, you know, in the short run, bariatric surgery loses weight, and that's where it ends. And so it seems that as an operation for people who have very high BMIs, it's extraordinarily effective, even though some people do not necessarily get better. But by and large, people do. And now with hypertension as a benefit, we're really home in a really nice way.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you're worried about things like adherence, you can't beat the adherence that you get from a surgical procedure. That weight loss occurs. There's some times a little bit of regain, but the more invasive the surgery, typically the more profound the weight loss. And, you know, other studies such as Stampede have shown resolution of diabetes in a significant proportion of patients undergoing bariatric surgery. So got benefits on diabetes, benefits on high blood pressure, benefits on the lipids. It's a pretty good risk factor reduction modality.
Does it make you better looking?
Well, you know, it's all in the eye of the beholder.
There have been Swedish studies suggesting benefit on mortality, too, studies that are much larger.
Yeah, the observational work, you're right.
Exactly right. I think the thing that's interesting about bariatric surgery is that the real benefit happens in patients who can find a level of discipline with movement and nutrition before they get the surgery. Good programs are requiring 6 months, a year, even a year and a half, demonstrate to me that you're not going to eat through the bypass surgery, because you can eat around bypass operation. We've all seen patients who do that. So this type of therapy, I think, makes the most sense in a very disciplined program that does that.
You know, one last word, and I think that it's important to point out that in programs that do well with bariatric surgery, the key, like in coronary artery bypass graft surgery or in any other kind of cardiac surgery, is a good surgeon as well. This is not a minor operation.
Yeah, no, that's right. Important. Really great point. And also, I think, Kim, the point you made about being in a program matters, because, you know, there are nutritional deficiencies and other things that crop up here. So these patients need to keep being followed. Otherwise, you know, they could get vitamin deficient, and then bad stuff can happen from that.
Exactly.
Okay, there we are. A good wrap-up of day two.
Thanks so much for listening to Eagle's Eye View, your weekly cardiovascular update from ACC.org. All of the material discussed on the podcast can be found on our ACC.org website. Find us online or wherever you get your podcasts.